This is the Imago Think Tank, and this is Wednesday, September 7th, and we are joined, as always, by our moderator, Tammy Nelson. Tammy, welcome.
Thanks, Kevin. I'm glad to be back, and thanks, Ed, for setting this up, and thank you so much, Harville, for being here, our very special guest. For those of you who need an introduction, and most of you won't need an introduction, to Harville Hendricks, our guest for today. Harville is the co-founder of Imago Relationships International with Helen Hunt, who unfortunately can't join us today, but she will be in Copenhagen at the conference to talk about this topic with Harville. They're the co-creators of Imago Relationship Therapy, and they created this concept of the conscious partnership. And today, Harville is going to talk about the topic that he's going to be speaking about with Helen at the conference in Denmark, which I hope you're all going to be joining us for. I really look forward to seeing you all in Copenhagen. And the topic is the challenge of creating change, Freud and the Buddha in dialogue with Imago. So welcome, Harville. I'm so excited to talk to you today about this topic, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tammy. Glad to be here.
Oh, it's so exciting. So can you tell us a little bit about this challenge of creating change, Freud and the Buddha, and how this relates to dialogue with Imago?
Yeah, I've been thinking about how to do this without giving away the punchline since we only have an hour here and we have an hour in, I think it's an hour in Copenhagen for the keynote, and maybe an hour and a half with some discussion thrown in there. But let me give you a little background about how this topic showed up. It was so there are really two sources of it, and one source is that I was invited to speak at a conference called the Summit for Clinical Excellence, and they titled their conference Freud and the Buddha, and they invited me to come. And usually, when I go to this conference, they say, ignore the title of our conference, talk about whatever you want to talk about. And I usually do ignore the title of conferences and talk about Imago. But this time, I thought that was an intriguing title, and decided that I would follow the title of conference. So they gave me a keynote slot, and so that's where that came from. And the reason I decided to talk about that title was that I know that what they were doing in this conference was dealing with the fact that Buddhism has developed in the Western world as a result of several people, Dan Siegel being one of the major ones, the focus on one of the axioms of Buddhism called mindfulness, and that mindful meditation is one of the forms of meditation in Buddhism, and also on the forms of meditation, among all the forms of meditation that have been migrating from the Eastern spiritual traditions into the Western spiritual world and the Western secular world now for something like 30 or 40 years, with varying relationships with psychotherapy. There are a number of books on Buddhism and psychotherapy that many people may know about, that discussion about the relationship between the conversational model of therapy in the Western world, in which people talk, which they talk in a context with another person who is a therapist, and the exploration of the of childhood and the inner world in the context of relating to this therapist. Compared to a very different practice, which one can do alone or can do in a group, but seldom, or one can do with one's teacher privately, but that fundamentally is not an expressive experience, but is an internal experience of an internal discipline of bringing awareness to focus, a consciousness to focus on, usually on one thing. It can be the breath, on a mantra, or in Christianity it can be an icon, or it can be a prayer. But the whole point is that there is a focus and full presence to one thing in the mind at one time. And the conversation about those two, the therapeutic efficacy of those two disciplines, was for a long time competitive in psychotherapy and in Buddhist practice, and has in the past probably decade become not only competitive but now complementary. That the conversations that therapists have with their clients are augmented by mindfulness practice at the beginning of a therapy session, or mindfulness practice as a between session assignment, as the development of the discipline of inwardness and outwardness has been going on. And that complementarity has now led to, I think, mindfulness being fully integrated into the practice of a lot of therapists, and is becoming discussed at very high levels by very visible figures like Dan Siegel, who has written many, many books on the mind, the brain of the mindful therapist, and mindfulness, and several other titles that I can't remember right now. But I think he has expanded this conversation about mindfulness in psychotherapy into understanding the impact of mindfulness on the brain, and has begun to make really clear that mindfulness meditation practice has positive impact on the brain, research on this has been about a 20-year project that's been going on between neuroscientists and the Dalai Lama, who's essentially challenged the neuroscientists to study the brains of meditating monks to see what impact the meditation practice has on the brains of the monks. And I think that the research on that has become definitively clear that meditation has an impact on the brain, and that it strengthens certain layers in the prefrontal cortex as a result of the discipline of focusing. So Dan Siegel has added this third element to it of mindfulness, psychotherapy, and the impact and brain studies together into some rather interesting and scintillating books. By the way, some of you may have just seen on the Imago Share network, on the Imago Share on the internet, that our own Bruce Krafischetz, who is a master trainer, has just published in the Psychotherapy Networker an article on dialogue as a form of relational mindfulness. And so mindfulness is now being talked about and discussed, and in fact identified with, or dialogue is being identified as a mindfulness practice. So that's the conversation now going on in therapy and in Buddhism. What doesn't appear to be going on is that psychotherapy is being integrated into the practice of mindfulness by especially more orthodox Buddhists. That conversation has not been going on. But the other conversation has been going on, a kind of eclecticism of the therapeutic process. And let me just clarify what that seems to be doing. I've said it, but let me just clarify it again. Is there seems to be a growing feeling that that if you have a therapeutic process that's fundamentally a conversation between a client and a therapist, and that conversation is about self-exploration, that if you augment that by a practice, of which can be fundamentally a disciplined practice of about 20 minutes twice a day, or more if you like, of going quiet and going inside and allowing yourself to be fully present to breathing, to your breathing, to a mantra or to something else, that that those two things in combination have therapeutic benefit. And what Dan Siegel has discovered about that benefit is that when you practice mindfulness, you regulate down the hyperactivity of the limbic system, of the amygdala, and by regulating it by using prefrontal cortex intentionality, that you eventually create a sense of inner calm and peace that is a replication of or similar to a sense of security or in the child. The secure child, somewhat like the Bowlby research people, Mary Main, Margaret Main, have done in when they identified the four types of the three types of insecurity, and in contrast to the secure child. In other words, that the mental state produced by meditation in combination with psychotherapy essentially regulates the anxiety of the insecurity that one might have as a result of childhood, and increases the and that decrease of anxiety increases a sense of well-being that one could consider to be that state of mind that precedes whatever caused the insecurity in childhood, or what we would call in Imago the rupture of connection. So that's a big conversation now going on in psychotherapy, and Helen and I have been talking about that. I have never practiced personally mindfulness. I have practiced a range of meditative disciplines. I'm a little lazy in the sense that one of my practices has been listening to a binaural tape, which I did for a period of several years. It was a very, very interesting experience and very, very helpful experience. Helen is a Baptist, but she has a Catholic practice of the rosary. And so she does the rosary actually on a daily basis right now, and has found that to be, she claims, extremely helpful to her. So we decided that we would take this conversation into the bowels of Imago at an annual conference and have that conversation there. I'm going to spend the time at the conference talking about the Buddha and Freud. I'm going to, and then Helen is going to talk about Imago as it relates to, is similar to, and contrast with the Buddha and with Freud. I decided that in looking over the time involved and looking over how narrow a niche of interest this topic may be to Imago therapists, it may be narrow, may be broad, don't know, but with the limits of time, that I would not try to do a comprehensive look at Buddhism in general, because Buddhism has changed a lot since the Buddha was sitting under the Bodhi tree and had his epiphany. Nor would I try to deal with all of the permutations that have developed in psychotherapy, and particularly out of the Freudian tradition, which is the tradition that out of which I come, fundamentally starting off in psychoanalysis something like 40 years ago. Being in analysis and being trained by analysts, and fundamentally developing a view of personality and therapy that was psychoanalytically oriented or psychodynamically oriented. I was never a practicing analyst, but that was my orienting background, to which I then added other things like Gestalt and transactional analysis and John Bowlby and relational psychoanalysis and other things and the object relations people later on, but fundamentally started there. So I decided that instead of trying to cover the complexity of the psychotherapeutic tradition and figure out all the things, that I would do something that I thought was manageable in the time frame that we've got, which is that I would focus on the founder of Buddhism and on the origins of mindfulness in the Buddha, and would also focus on the founder of psychotherapy, Sigmund Freud, and on the fundamental principles that he had, and focus both of those people on the question of the problematic in the human situation, what Buddha would call it suffering, what is suffering, what causes suffering, what mitigates suffering, and what happens to you after suffering. I would focus on those fundamental questions in both Buddha and in Freud. And then Helen would focus on the same questions with Imago, and that she would probably spend 15 minutes on Buddha, 15 minutes on Freud, and 15 minutes on Imago. So you know it'll be a quick snapshot of what I would consider, with all of the awareness of how grandiose this sounds, three major perspectives on change that are now operative in the Western world. Three major perspectives, and that Imago, while it may be a newcomer to the field, is in fact a distinct conceptual system and a distinct therapeutic system and practice that that establishes itself in the conversation with the Buddha and with Freud about the nature of change, and I think establishes some parameters about what change is that were not available in the Buddha and mindfulness, or in Freud and psychoanalysis, that many of us now know about. So that's fundamentally what we're going to do. Just to reiterate, we will, in the lecture, address fundamentally four questions, and this is the question that faces us all when we are in the therapeutic position, that the question is, when people come to see us, what's going on, and we know that at some level they are suffering. So we're going to ask the question, what is suffering Buddhism, identify the Buddha in Buddhism and in mindfulness? What is suffering? That's a universal question. It's one of the reasons all of us are in the field of psychotherapy, I think, is because we are drawn to mitigate human suffering in as much as we can. And then we'll ask a question of what causes suffering. What is it and what causes it? And when we get to what causes it, it's interesting that what suffering is very different, differently outlined by Freud and the Buddha. And what causes the suffering is different, although the common interest is suffering and its causes. What cures suffering is also very different, and what conditions will exist in the mind after suffering has been cured are different in those two traditions, and that Imago is different from those two differences in terms of what suffering is, what causes it, what cures it, and what is the mental or affective or life condition after suffering has been cured. So it's going to be a fun exercise to set up those three major conversations about the nature of change, because it deals with the fundamental question of who we are, as human beings, how come we are the way we are in terms of how come we're suffering? How did we get that way? And what do we have to do in order to get out of human suffering? And I think all therapists have been called into that mission to do something about human suffering, and that all of us have some sense of what the state of life would be when the suffering is over, and what we did, what we have to do, and what it'll be like when we're not suffering anymore. And is there? And then one of the fundamental other questions is is there a state beyond suffering? That is, do we constantly suffer and constantly have to go through some form of healing or mitigation or repair to relieve suffering, only to suffer again? Or is there a state where one can get to in the mind or in relationship to the one or to the center, and in which suffering is transcended forever without any change in that? And that's a really fundamentally an interesting question, which I think constantly plagues all of us in the field of couples therapy about a follow-up and follow-through. That is, do couples get to a place that they stay, or do they get out of one degree of suffering or decrease suffering so that they're not suffering as much? Do they have moments in which they're not suffering at all, but then they're still vulnerable to suffering again? And then, so consequently, there's a constant sense of the need for repair and or reconciliation or whatever one has to go through in order not to feel the pain that has driven one into some sort of relationship with another person who's a healer, or into some sort of practice like meditation and mindfulness. So I think that what I might could do, Tammy, is to say that that's the reason the conversation is going on. That's the context in which the conversation would place, and that what we could do is stop now and have responses to this, and then any questions. And can add a little bit to this in terms of content, but as I said, don't want to give the lecture now that I'm going to give there. And what I've just been talking about is actually preparation for this conversation, and probably very little of it will be repeated in Copenhagen, because it's taken about 25 minutes to set up this lecture, and in Copenhagen, if I take that long, half of the lecture time will have been gone. So there, we'll go straight into the conversation. But today, I just wanted to set up what it's about so that we can use this time as marketing, hopefully, that those of you who are on the fence about going to Copenhagen will be so excited and desirous of having the answer to the question of human suffering that's been posed by three major traditions in the history of humankind, and will show up there in order to get the answer.
So great. So we'll open it up for some questions, Harville. And I just have a quick question. Will you talk about sort of how these new ideas over the past few years have about mindfulness and Buddhism have sort of influenced your new ideas about conscious partnership? Because it sounds like, you know, the Freud and the analysis have sort of influenced your earlier work, and now you have this new part of your thinking that's influenced by mindfulness and Daniel Siegel, how he's integrated into our practice. Is that something that you're going to talk about as well, sort of how you've grown from that new information that you're sort of integrating into your thoughts?
Well, I'm going to, I'm going to talk about the interface, but what fundamentally I would want to make clear is an old saw that I keep doing every time I get a hold of a microphone, which is that Imago operates in a different paradigm than psychotherapy operates in, and therefore Freud and all of the Freudian tradition, except for relational psychoanalysis, which is a sub form of psychoanalysis that evolved in the 1970s and still doesn't have much press, and that it's also a very different paradigm from the paradigm of mindfulness. And while it is clear, and I think Bruce is onto something, that dialogue could be called a relational meditation, that the development of dialogue and also the development of the concepts of healing that are now dominant in Imago are not compatible with the paradigms in Freud. And the incompatibility has to do with the fact that that the Buddhist tradition, and the Buddha in particular, was the son of a tribal chieftain, and that the Buddha lived in a tribal consciousness in which there was no such thing as individuality, and that you were a member of the tribe and you belonged to the tribe and you are responsible for tribe cohesion, and there was very little support for autonomy, independence, and there was, of course, no possibility of self-sufficiency, because if you were anti-tribal, you were tend to be excluded from the tribe, and then you became a wanderer. Now, he was not excluded from the tribe, but what he did see, it appears to me, what he did see as he looked around himself at the time, which was about 400 BC, as he looked around, he saw suffering everywhere. And he was aware that his noble position as the son of the tribal chieftain, and that his father himself was not doing anything about the suffering. And he, in fact, didn't do anything about the suffering. He was disturbed by it. So he went into the forest and thought about it a lot, and sat and his. And he sat with the question of what is suffering, and enlightenment for him was for him enlightenment was understanding the cause of suffering. That's what enlightenment, and so then that's what gave rise. But the focus there for the Buddha was that by going inward, he in fact broke out of the tribal consciousness, and was the beginning of what I think could be the case. He was the beginning of the rise of the individual within the tribe, and ultimately with democracy some 2,500 years later, separate from the tribe, that there was the individual appeared. Now, Freud shows up at a time when the individual was king, when the whole question was how do we be a self? And so when he started to work, he started with that question of how to be a self, and his focus was on the self, and he was the radical surgeon of the interior of the self. He gave Helen calls it the physics of the inner world. The physics of the intrapsychic was created by Freud. And for him, the question of suffering did not compare to very well to the question of suffering in the Eastern traditions, nor did it compare very much to the form of suffering in the Western spiritual traditions, which was the only other sort of group that dealt with human suffering the church and the mosque and the synagogues, until the rise of psychotherapy with Freud now about 140 years ago. But the focus in Freud was on the self, and was on self-awareness and self-consciousness and autonomy and independence and self-sufficiency, as if the self was not in relation, as that somehow it was distinct from its context. And while that has changed and changed over time, and I've been influenced by those changes in relational psychotherapy and in object relations and in attachment theory, those have influenced me in the direction of the relational paradigm. There are ways in which imago goes beyond object relations and goes and very much is in alignment with relational psychoanalysis about the nature of human nature, the nature of suffering, and the nature of change. A dialogue, however, is has been Helen and I have been talking about dialogue for probably 15 or 20 years as a spiritual practice. We were invited in some to go to some spiritual retreat centers many, many years ago, and we decided that these spiritual retreat centers were focused on meditation, and that and everything in the curriculum was the privacy of the self, the individual, and so we decided, and looking at that, that dialogue offered another path to the same goal that mindfulness or other forms of meditation and breath work offered, and that but that it was more more challenging than meditation, because to focus in dialogue, you have to focus on another person's self-expression, and it's way more challenging to remain centered as you focus on somebody else talking than it is to remain centered while you are, in fact, paying attention and focusing on the arising of your own thoughts or on your own breath or on a mantra or on something that you can control. So we began to language dialogue as a spiritual practice that was more challenging, but we also thought it was probably, in some sense, more effective. Because if you have to work harder to make something happen, you then probably get a stronger benefit out of that. And then Theresa Beaton did some research for her dissertation or post-dissertation work and has a paper that we're trying to get published now that very few people may know about. But the paper has to do with doing brain scans and brain measurements of people who have done dialogue in a workshop with 12 weeks of follow-up. And that research has established that within the workshop and 12 weeks of dialogue, meeting once a week and practicing dialogue once a week in a group, was so impactful on the brain that it, in fact, was measurable. There was a measurable change in the same area of the brain that occurs when people meditate, or when the Dalai Lama's Buddhist monks were, their brains were studied. So that our hunch long ago was that dialogue had a similar impact that meditation had, but we had no data. We just except the data of clinical experience, and now we have that data. So dialogue did not arise in competition with meditation, but it was a kind of a serendipitous awareness that we were in dialogue is, in fact, a discipline. It is, in fact, a practice. It does have the qualities of focused attention that meditation has, but the focused attention is on a different object, which is the self-expression of another person. And while you're listening to another person express themselves, you regulate your own emotions and direct your attention away from your own experiencing, which is different from meditation, to the experiencing of another person. But in doing that, you strengthen the same areas in the prefrontal cortex that is strengthened by meditation. That's a long response to your question. I don't know if I even answered it, but at least I responded to it.
Well, actually, you did. In ways that, you know, I hope I didn't push you to give away some of the great stuff you're going to talk about in Copenhagen, but I find it to really be the piece that's so resonant and makes so much sense when you talk about dialogue as the spiritual practice of it. I mean, that's the part that makes, you know, so much sense to me, and I think to many other people, because of the practice of it, that it is a practice, just like a yoga practice or a meditation practice. It's something that you get better at, that it's not easy, that it's a, you know, a process that that brings you closer to a spiritual goal, and that it's, you know, it's something that you aspire to, that you don't get perfect at, and that not only does the practice of it benefit you, but it benefits someone else, which seems to be the beauty of it. All of that is very resonant.
Yeah. And I think that one of the subtle distinctions is that in the meditative traditions, the term of achievement through meditation is the experience of oneness. And at least that's the biggest term. I notice now in the new literatures that are arising, and even in integral psychology, which is championed by Ken Wilber, they're beginning to use the word connection as well as oneness, and are beginning to talk about relationality. But I think that the without that sort of transition that seems to be occurring in those individually focused traditions moving toward a relationality, without that what happens in dialogue is not so much the experience of oneness as it is the experience of connection.
Mm-hmm.
That we are not so much all one. We may all be a part of the one, but we are distinct and connected. And that what dialogue does is achieve that distinction, which is the curing of symbiotic merger, which is the source of conflict and fantasy and all kinds of horrible things that most of us don't want to have anything to do with, annihilating the other because you're not like me. That when you cure that, when you end symbiosis, what you move to is not a oneness, but a distinction from and connection with your partner. And that in fact is what mirrors the universe, because nothing in the universe is one with the other, with something else. Everything is a part of the one and a part of the whole, but there's no merger. There's a distinction. Like, I'm looking at trees outside now, and there are, you know, maybe 500,000 leaves on a tree. But all those leaves are distinct, but they're all connected to the tree. And the awareness of that as a result of dialogue, I think, is the basis of joy. And that's the same kind of experience that happens in meditation. So it may in fact turn out to be the same thing, but there are subtle distinctions in language, and some of imago was developed simply in parallel, and that we discovered their similarity. Hardly any of it was directed over against anything, but simply distinct from both the primarily from the analytic portions of the psychotherapeutic tradition.
Well, that I like what you said about the. The oneness is not the universe, it's being part of the one. I think that has a lot to do with what we experience as the therapist when people have this sort of existential terror of losing their self if they risk that, you know, connection, even for some people having, you know, eye contact, or the risk of being in that, you know, transforming place. It can be so scary because of exactly what you're saying, the fear of losing themselves. And so what you're putting out is that you can be distinct and connected, and I think that that goal and giving people a taste of that is incredibly healing. And I like how you put that. I'm writing it down as you're saying it.
Yeah, and I think that is the healing experience, is that I am distinct from you, and therefore there's a clear boundary, and I am connected to you, and so there's a clear relationship. One of the startling analogies to this is from the brain sciences, which I, you know, should have known but didn't know, is that all the cells, I think there are, 50 trillion cells in the brain, something like that. All those cells are all distinct. That is, there's no fiber running from one cell to the other. Between every cell, there's a synapse, which is a little gap between the axon and the dendrite, and that's the synapse. And what passes across from the axon to the dendrite is a signal, but there's a space there. And Helen is using this synaptic connection as a metaphor for the space between with couples. There is a space, and what crosses that space is a signal. It's a communication. And for a long time, the orthodox cellular biology assumed that this signal was a chemical signal, and because they could measure that. Then Bruce Lipton comes along, and he notices that there are different chemicals that occur in that synaptic space. Sometimes the chemicals are things like endorphins, and sometimes they're chemicals like cortisol. And so the question was, how do you account for the change of the chemicals that's communicating across that space? And he said that the only way he could account for it was that there was an electrical signal influencing the chemical signal, and that electrical signal or energetic signal was in fact thought. So that the thinking content of thought in the brain influences the chemistry in the space between the axon and the dendrite, that synapse is determined by the state of one's mind. So healing is that experience of being in relationship to another, like one cell to another, and connection is when the chemicals in your own bloodstream are endorphins rather than cortisol. And that's what determines the quality of that space. And Helen refers to the space between as, and when it has negativity in it, that space is toxic and therefore becomes a source of anxiety. And when the space between is safe and non-toxic and the endorphins and maybe dopamine go, then that space produces the emotion of joy.
Boy, and that sort of brings you back to being mindful of your thoughts when you're in
yes,
your relationship.
Yes, doesn't it, though? that you're the one changing the chemistry of your own synaptic connections.
Right, which influences your relationship.
Which influences, yeah, because if you have a negative attitude and you produce then cortisol in your own blood system, that is experienced subjectively by you as a threat coming from the outside.
Right.
And
fascinating.
So then you react toward your partner as if they were the ones having the negative thought, but it's actually your projective imagination. That sucks.
Right.
It really
Well, Harville, I want to open it up to make sure that people, if they have burning questions, have time. So I just want to remind people, because I could keep Harville all to myself all afternoon, but I want to remind people that if they have themselves in lecture mode, they could hit, if they've hit *6, hit *7 to take yourself out of lecture mode, and just say your name and speak up if you have a question or a comment. And maybe someone could just speak up so I can make sure that you're not in lecture mode and we can hear you. Because I did not put people in lecture mode, so we should be able to have an open dialogue where I can hear people, unless Kevin or Ed put people in lecture mode. Harville, are you still there?
I'm still here, yeah.
Okay, so why don't you keep talking, because maybe there's some kind of problem with their, you know, synaptic connection and we can't hear them.
Yes, it could be that the conversation was so uninteresting that everybody's gone. That's one of my worries when I go into these sort of high-level conceptual interface conversations, is that that's interesting only to me and my own self-ruminations, but not to anybody else. So that could be the case.
My guess is more likely that we are on some kind of, lecture mode where people can't respond. But I do hear some background noise, so I'm guessing that somebody is there.
Hi, this is Kate from Northern Virginia.
Hi, can you just speak up a little bit? Because there's a little bit of background noise. Very interesting.
I haven't formulated a question. I just wanted to tell you I was here. This is Kate from Northern Virginia. Hi.
So you're still there.
This is Noreen in Portland. Can you hear me?
Hi, Noreen. Yes, we can hear you. Just speak up a little.
Hi, Noreen.
Hi.
And if you're just in listening mode, you can put yourself back in lecture mode by hitting star 6. Thanks.
Sharon in Tucson.
I do have a question.
Okay, please speak up.
And Harvard, bringing this down to what we do in a session with a couple.
Yeah.
You know me, I'm really pragmatic. I want to know what the heck I'm supposed to do with this information in a session.
Yeah.
And so could you speak to that from the Imago paradigm? You know, how could we be using this in our daily sessions with people?
Well, there's a huge...
And hold on one second, Harville. Whoever is listening now, could you please put yourself on moderator mode, which is by hitting star 6 so that there's no background noise, so we can hear. So if you've taken yourself off, just hit star 6. That would be great. Thank you. Harville, you just have to speak up a little bit louder because people are still...
Yeah, there's somebody's phone is open, and the background noise is really deafening.
We can't hear you, we can.
Okay. I'll speak up over that and to Noreen's question about what to do with all of this. So I think there are two things to do with it, and one of the things that I've always been interested in as a trainer is that a therapist needs to think about and reflect upon their own operating model of what is it they're doing in the session. That is, what is the suffering that's being brought to them? And that everybody does have some sort of model, and it may be conscious or unconscious. And secondly, what is it that you're doing to address that? And what is the outcome that you're looking for? So it's very important, and just as it was for the Buddha, for him to get clear in meditation, what was wrong, why it was wrong, and why were you doing this meditation? What was that, and what sort of condition was that to bring? Just to have your mind filled with some sense of theoretical operations, and then the practice, then, because that's what brings intelligence to the practice. Because if you know what you're addressing, then you know that this particular methodology or tool may or may not help that. You know, it's a rock you want to smash, not a jar you want to open. So it requires two different kinds of tools. And I think in Imago, we pretty much assume that when people come to us, that their suffering is a result of a connectional rupture that has been re-ruptured in their relationship, and that they are fundamentally anxious, and their anxiety is resulting in defensive behavior. And that defensive behavior is their attempt to protect themselves from their own anxiety, and that attempt has usually triggered anxiety in their partner. And that what we have to do is help them regulate down, as Siegel would say, prefrontal cortex, regulating down the limbic system so that they can reduce their anxiety and drop their defenses, and then restore connection with each other, and then relate to each other in such a way over a long enough period of time that they can have sustainable connection. And when they have that, then they have repaired the rupture that occurred in their childhood with their caretakers. They've repaired that in the relationship. So I think that the dialogue process appears to be the container to contain that conversation, and that what we need to do is hold people in that conversation, that we don't treat them, we're not doctors, we don't do things to them, we're not intrusive, we're simply holders of the space within which the couples have a guided conversation about their anxiety. In such a way that the anxiety, it's a paradox, in such a way that the anxiety goes down or decreases. And as the anxiety goes down and decreases, they then begin to access more and more aspects of themselves, which they can then share. And you know the drill there. As you as you become more curious about your partner, which is one aspect of the dialogue process, more curious, your partner feels less anxious and can become more present with their authenticity. And if that authenticity is mirrored and held and validated and empathized with, gives visibility to the partner who is sending, and that visibility that they experience in the relationship repairs the invisibility injury that was experienced by everybody in childhood. So I think that those are the two things, is that it's really, to me, very good. And I know I've had this conversation with a therapist and with even with the faculty for a long time. It's really important that a good therapist have an operating conceptual system, and so that their operations, when they do something, is consistent with that system, so that they can, and it either works or doesn't work. If it does work, you keep the conceptual system. If it doesn't work, then you have to alter the conceptual system. But at least you have one that's unconscious, and you're doing stuff because of that, or you have one that's conscious and you're doing stuff because of that. So it's essentially becoming a kind of enlightened, informed, and intentional therapist with an intentional theory and an intentional practice, which is, I think, what makes a really good therapist. And that gives you the capacity to be really present to your client rather than anxious yourself about what you're supposed to be doing.
So, Noreen, I just want to check with you to see if that answered your question before we close.
Yes, what I'm hearing is two things. One is that the answer to my question, first and foremost, lies in being a mindful therapist, being aware of where I am, being present. And so there's that part. And then part two is, of course, how it fits to our imago paradigm, is we are helping people understanding the source of their suffering and understanding that the problem is not the problem, that we're helping them understand that through discovering that the problem is not the problem, but the rupture is the problem, and the continued rupture.
Yeah.
So all of that makes sense, Harville. I really like the way you put that together.
Thank you.
Harville, we only have 1 minute left, so I wanted to just put in a last-minute plug for people, if they haven't decided to come to the conference, to think about coming to Denmark. I saw an email today that said that the flights have actually gone down to come to Copenhagen. So if you are thinking about it and you haven't decided to come, please join us and come see Harville and Helen speak. And to thank you, Harville, so much for coming on today to talk about this really fascinating topic. And we'll look forward to hearing more at the conference.
Okay. We'll be there. And Helen sent you her greetings.
And happy birthday,
thanks, Harville.
Your birthday was this week. Happy birthday.
Thank you. I got about 100 greetings from Facebook. So whoever sent them, thank you very much. And I'll get the response at some point.
Okay, and thanks, everybody, for being here today. We'll see you next week.
Thank you, Tammy.
Thanks, Harville.
Bye.
Thank you.